What can we understand about the universe? And how do we understand exactly what's going on, figuring out expansion and all this stuff? So my plan for the four lectures is that first we're just going to today just get comfortable. So I'm assuming that you guys are comfortable, have at least spent some time thinking about the expanding universe, but I really just want to go back to the beginning and say, what's going on in expansion? So who here has taken a cosmology course? Okay, so about half or something like that, so that's perfect. So the plan, as I see it, is that, so we'll get all up to speed with the expanding universe, and I'm going to tell you some things that those of you that have taken cosmologists, at least some of you are not going to believe me. You'll think I'm telling you some lies. I assure you I'm not lying. And those of you that haven't taken a cosmology course, well, so now, hopefully by the time it's over today, it'll all be demystified. So then tomorrow we'll talk about cosmic microwave background fluctuations. And so this is sort of the leading way of understanding our universe today, that I think most of the stuff that we trust about cosmology comes from the cosmic microwave background. The next lecture will be about clustering of galaxies. So we look out and you see pairs and clumps of galaxies all over the place. And connecting that with what you heard about last week. So first I'll have to figure out exactly what you heard about it last week by talking to you guys. But my goal is to connect what you heard last week to what you'll hear this week and the observations. So today on the archive, the new results came out from the Planck satellite. So they finally released their CMB power spectrum and the likelihood code. So, so we'll try to figure out how that all fits in. And then the last lecture will be about gravitational lensing. And so gravitational lensing is this wonderful way to understand the matter fluctuations in the universe, and not just the light, but actually the matter. All right, so let's learn some cosmology. So I don't know how many of you believe in the multiverse.
That's the host.
Who here believes in the multiverse? Okay.
Wow.
Really? Like none of the levels of the multiverse? How can you not believe in at least some version of it? Okay. So in some, if there are some parallel universes with alternate realities, there are several, and I would think actually most of them, where we knew the universe was accelerating, was expanding long before general relativity. That the expansion of the universe has nothing to do with general relativity, and if you think about it for a second, it shouldn't. So it's not expanding close to the speed of light, at least locally. So yeah, sure, once you get to very large scales, you start getting into the speed of light issues. And the potentials are tiny. So there's no reason you should think that you would need GR to describe an expanding universe. And so just to convince you that that's true, let's just go back to the old Navier-Stokes equations. And you can just write down the fluid equation. So there's a continuity equation which says that d rho dt plus div v is equal to zero. So that's the continuity equation. And that just says that if you have some spot, if the density is changing, things are either flowing into it or out of it. Do the same thing with the Euler equation. So you get some dv dt plus v dot grad. So here you can see what I mean when I say that I come from an astrophysics background, that to me, this is the natural way to do everything. You just start with the fluid equations. Oh wait, grad p minus grad phi. And then the Poisson equation, because it's self-gravitating. And you look at these equations, and people looked at these equations for a very long time. So I've, there's no viscosity in here. This is just the simplest version, where it's just an ideal fluid. And now let's say we want to think about our universe as a whole. And so let's say, okay, well, let's say there's a universe and we're post-Copernican. So that means that we don't think we're at the center of it. And we think that, well, maybe it's roughly the same everywhere we look. And if all you do is you take these equations and you say, what if I want the density to be constant in space? Which is to say that everywhere, so this just says, I'm just going to say that everywhere in the universe has the same density. So automatically, just this one constraint gives you a very interesting insight, which is you look at the Poisson equation. And if this constant in space density is not zero, your del squared phi is some constant, which means your potentials are not constant. There's constant curvature in the potential everywhere in the universe, which means that everywhere in the universe, if you stick down an observer and you say, what's the local potential look like? The local potential is going to look like some bowl. And so that's already a little bit weird. So now you would say, okay, well, fine, maybe I'm not going anywhere. But if the potential always has this curvature to it, it has to be the case that people that are off center from where I am have to be seeing some net gradient, which means you would naturally expect that there has to be some net motion in the universe if rho is constant and not zero, that it's unavoidable. And so you already can see where it's going to go. And so then you just go and you put in an assumption that rho is constant. Let's just assume that p is zero just to keep our life simple for simplicity. And what else do we want to do? I think that's all we need to put in. So if you just put in these two assumptions that rho is constant everywhere, and for simplicity, just go with pressureless matter. So that way you don't have to worry about this term. And then you just say, well, let's just solve these equations. And there is a solution. And so the first thing you're going to do, so you already know that this potential is this bowl-shaped thing. And so automatically what that's going to tell you is that grad phi is just going to be proportional to r. This says there's some acceleration acting on everything. The further away you get, everything starts to be moving away from you. So you just plug all these things in. And the first thing you'll find, so you can simplify your life and just do spherical symmetry, but you don't need to. So in spherical symmetry, it's easy because you know what all these gradients are, right? So you can just take all these gradients, write them all down. And the first thing you'll find when you start mucking around with all these things is you get d log rho by dt is equal to minus 1 over r squared d by dr of r squared v. And again, we have this weird situation where you have this change in the density as a function of time has something to do with the spatial gradients in these velocities. So remember that we just showed, just from the Poisson equation, that the potentials have to have this curvature to them, which means there need to be some velocities that you're picking up as a function of r. And then the spatial gradient in these velocities are now going to change that cause the density to be changing in time. So you basically take these equations, you muck around, you take this one, you plug it into that Euler equation, and what you find is you get that there's velocity as a function of r is minus 1/3 times some function of t, which is this d log rho d dot dt times r. And so what you get is you get velocity is some constant times r is the solution of those equations. And this could have been written down in 1800. That if you want to live in a universe that has constant density in space, you have to have this velocity profile around any observer. There's no gr, there's nothing funny here. And then there's this coefficient out front right here. So then you take that thing and you solve for what that is. Now that we know what V of R is, you can throw that into here. And what you'll find is that the solution of this is you get that rho is 1 over 6 pi g. That's a 6 and that's a g. T to the minus 2. That's the solution. So just from ordinary Newtonian physics from 1800, you get that rho of t is following this. And then, so you look at exactly how that fits into here, and you muck around with some equations. And what you'll find is you get that some rho dot over rho is what this thing is. So that's minus 2 over t. And now you just say, okay, well, that's so this is in terms of the density, but what if I imagine some typical scale in the universe, and you just say that, which way do I go? So I pull this one down and this one all the way up. Oh, I screwed up the boards, didn't I? No, it's okay. We'll be okay. We'll be fine. All right. So you get that, and now we just say we have this density. What do we do with that? Well, it's just matter expanding, right? It's pressureless matter. And so you take some little box. You have some box. You have your box full of matter, and you want to see what the density is. Well, you know that the density is the mass in the box over some volume of the box, 4/3 pi a cubed. And the only way to change the density in that box is to vary the size of it. So that says that I can say d log rho by dt, which is just this rho dot over rho. From just looking at this, I can see that that's minus 3 a dot over a. So the size of my box is just getting stretched and scaled as I change the density. So I have a minus 3 a dot over a. I have rho dot over rho is minus 2 over t. Rho is all that. I throw all this stuff together, put it all in a big blender, and what's going to come out is I get a dot over a squared is equal to 8/3 pi g rho. And so those of you that have taken cosmology will recognize that this thing right here is the Friedmann equation. And so if you're doing this in GR, you would be doing something like taking the left-hand side and setting it equal to basically taking the trace of Einstein's equations, and what you'll get out is something that looks kind of like this. So in GR, this comes out. And so for pressureless matter, we've derived the Friedmann equation. And now that's cool, but there's kind of as far as we can go. Because now, let's say that we don't have pressureless matter. So if we want to add pressure, what are we supposed to do? Well, so there's no role of pressure in classical Newtonian gravity, right? So in order to actually figure out how to include the effects of pressure or anything else, so if we add radiation to this mix, so radiation has stuff moving around at the speed of light, so you know that you might need relativity. So whenever you have things moving relativistically, relativity becomes important, sort of tautologically. However, so for this we need GR. However, it's minimal GR. It's really just writing down, it's almost the easiest thing you can do in GR. Now, of course, GR is almost a step function. It goes from the easiest things you can do to the things you can't do. So this is right on the upturn. So you plug all this in into Einstein's equations, and what you find that the correct answer is that a dot over a squared is 8/3 pi g times rho, but this rho is now the density of everything in the universe. So this is rho matter plus rho radiation plus rho anything else you could think of. So anything that exists that has energy density goes into this rho, not just regular old density of matter. So it wouldn't just be the density of this block of this table. It would also be, you'd have to include the energy density and the light that's rattling around in this room and all that stuff. And in principle, there's another term on this, plus k over a squared. And this k is a radius of curvature. And in fact, in what we were doing before, if we'd been careful about keeping our constants of integration, this would have popped out as a constant of integration somewhere along the line. So at some point, I just set a constant of integration to zero, and since I didn't actually derive anything, you didn't notice. So this term right here in the GR context corresponds to this k curvature of space. So this is the curvature. So if you allow some spatial curvature, you'll end up with this term contributing. Now, empirically, what we know is that this term is extremely small. So inflation did this for us, and we think. Something did it for us. Something managed to set this term to be extremely small. And it's a good thing for us that whatever it was did it, because as long as this term is really small, all of our integrals will be much easier. So if you need proof that there is a benevolent creator, the fact that we can do all of these calculations without inverse hyperbolic signs is clearly evidence, right? So that's one of the Friedman equations you can get out. There's another one that involves the acceleration. And now the acceleration, I'm going to need this. 15. So using the same machinery, you can also find that A double dot over A is equal to some different number minus 4 pi g over 3 times the sum over all the components you could have, rho I plus 3 pi, where this I could be matter, radiation, or anything else. And I'm sure as many of you, if not all of you know, this question mark would include dark energy. So that's what we need to know. So we have this equation here, is the Friedman equation that just tells you A dot over A depends on the densities. And so this one here is telling you something else about how they interact with pressures, but since we already know what some of these components are, like matter and radiation, we can do things like you can write that rho matter is whatever it is at some early time times A over A0, or some late time, when to the minus 3. And that's saying as you stretch your box, it's just going to go as the volume of the box. For radiation, you have the same minus 3 because you have some box full of photons. You stretch your box, and you're diluting the number of photons by a factor of A to the minus 3, but you're also diluting the wavelength of each photon, which means the energy density is now going to go as rho to the minus 4. Now, the weird one, well, so in principle, you can write any old thing you want. And the parameterization that has caught on is this one, where you just write Wx is defined so that rho x times Wx is equal to Px. And this is, they call this the equation of state of the dark energy, but it's not really an equation of state. There's no derivatives involved, so it's kind of a cheat to call it an equation of state. But if you just need to be able to somehow characterize the relation between pressure and density, so you can figure out exactly how the expansion, how this thing is going to redshift away, you might write it this way. Now, so when you do this, you can then sort of see exactly how these things map in. So for this, in this W parameterization, you get that for pressureless matter, W equals zero. And that's saying it's pressureless, right? That's just dust. So pressureless stuff, there's no interactions. For radiation, you have to know that the radiation pressure goes as the density to the one, is one-third the photon energy density. So that's just for a black body. You say, what's the radiation pressure compared to the energy density in the photon bath? And you get a factor of one-third. You get W of one-third. And then you can get all sorts of things. Now, something that's caught on recently is this idea of dark energy. And I'll show you why it's caught on, because it turns out to actually matter. But what if you had something that was completely constant as you expand the universe? so in time and space. So what do you need for that? Well, for that, you need W of minus 1. And that's a weird thing to think about. Yep.
I think the exponents need some lines.
It's definitely missing minus sign. Thank you. And the reason you want that to be minus 1 is that it makes this whole thing equal to 0, and then you get a Rose constant. So these are some of the things, as far as we know, these are all the things that are in our universe. And so we now know everything we need to plug into that Friedmann equation. But this thing's a little bit weird. W of minus 1. And why is it weird? Well, let's look at the second Friedmann equation. So this, you plug in W of minus 1, that says the pressure is minus the energy density. So you get that the acceleration of the universe is this number right here. So in general, you would expect things to be decelerating. And again, let's put your Newtonian hat back on and say, I have a bunch of things that are self-gravitating, and they are in some configuration, but they should all be pulling on each other. So you really would not expect the universe to just be accelerating or expanding and expanding and expanding. At the very least, that expansion should be slowing down because gravity holds everything together. So for pressureless matter, that says that this is zero. So it's just saying that it's the expansion of the universe, so this, the rate at which the size of this box changes is negative. So that makes sense. That just says you throw a ball up, it comes back. If a bunch of balls go flying away from each other, they'll have a tendency to slow down under their own mutual gravity. Radiation, no problem. In fact, that actually adds to the deceleration because you add this plus 1/3. So this is a positive number, this is a positive number. But once this is negative, and in fact, anything less than minus 1/3, but when it's minus 1, you get that this thing right here is decelerating by an amount that is rho minus 3 times rho, minus 2 rho, which means it's flipped the sign. And that says that if you have something that is roughly constant in time and space, it actually has the effect of driving expansion. So this drives expansion. And you see it right there in the math, and you can't argue with the math, but it's still a little weird. And so lots of people have different ways of trying to understand why this would be. For me, the easiest way to understand this is just to imagine some sphere. So you have some spherical ball, and let's say it has some constant density. And if it had constant density and you just expand it, well, you know that the binding energy per particle, you have some thing that's of order gm over r, right? This is the magic thing to worry about, is gm over r. Now imagine what happens if you take that ball and you expand it. Well, if you expand it or contract it, you'll change this r. So that's roughly this gravitational binding energy. So you expand it, and you're reducing this thing right here. And I guess this is also a negative, right? And so it says that if you expand this thing, R gets bigger, so the gravitational binding energy is going down, which means you're reducing the energy of the whole system is going up. And similarly, if you contract this thing, this goes down, it becomes more tightly bound. So if you want to think about gravity as being that thing that makes things more tightly bound, it causes shells like this to contract. However, this thing has rho of constant in time and space, and in that case, what's happening is that when you expand or contract this shell, your mass is changing. Because remember, your mass is 4/3 pi r cubed times rho. So for normal stuff, yeah, you of course, if you're stretching the shell or contracting the shell, the mass is obviously going to stay fixed, and you're just changing how far that mass is from the origin. But if you're putting in a constraint that no matter how much I contract or expand that shell, this density has to stay constant, the effective mass of my shell has gone up when I expand this thing, which means my gravitational binding energy has gone from being, so now I have this binding energy is of order minus G times 4/3 pi r squared. Which means as I expand my shell, I'm actually making it more tightly bound. So the way to make dark energy be more and more tightly bound and is to just keep expanding and expanding and expanding. It's a very strange thing. And it just comes from this constraint that we are putting in this requirement that this density is constant in all time and space. And so, finding ways to come up with things that do this is a full-time job, or it was a full-time job for probably half of the cosmology theorists for a while a few years ago. And there's no, I wouldn't say any of the solutions are exactly compelling, so no offense, Cliff, but, where it comes from, who knows. But what you can see is that if this thing exists, you are going to have this property that your acceleration, your universe is going to start accelerating away from itself. So, yeah. Yeah.
Finally, if we forget the W equals minus 1 and just go back to the original example,
yeah.
There the universe is still expanding even though we're just taking normal
pressure
less matter.
Yeah, so it's still expanding, but it's decelerating the whole time. And it's the same way of going back to this idea of the thing I erased. You have this big spherical potential, right? And so imagine just in regular... So you have this spherical potential, and you know that things are going to have a tendency to get drawn down the sides of that bowl, but you also know that if you set something rolling up the side of that, if you set it rolling fast enough, it won't necessarily ever manage to turn around and come back down. And so there's an initial condition, which is that the universe was expanding sufficiently fast early on that it didn't very quickly recollapse, roll up a little bit and then come back down. And that's one of the mysteries of cosmology.
So my question exactly was going to be that. Does it require a precise initial condition, or is it stable to perturbations such as the
So inflation solves a lot of this. So in some ways, the speed at which things are expanding has something to do with the curvature of space in GR, because space-time curvature corresponds to how tightly bound things are. So in the absence of something like inflation, that would be what was known as the fine-tuning problem, which is why is it that the universe is so close to expanding at the magic rate where it looks like it. So we'll get to that in a second. So the universe is expanding at some rate, and then you look around and you say, well, how fast is it expanding? And it's been expanding for a long time, which is to say that there is that bowl and you set some marble going up the bowl. And it's amazing that marble is going sort of at a speed that seems well matched to the curvature of that potential. Which you wouldn't naively expect, that if you just show up at some random spot in time and someone a long time ago set a bowl rolling up the side of a marble going up the side of a bowl, what are the odds that it's rolling at about that speed that you can't quite tell whether it's going to keep going up for a long time or turn around and come back? You would think that a long time ago it would have either just taken off and be long gone, such that the curvature of the bowl barely even is noticeable, or it would have stopped and turned around and come plowing down. So that is definitely a fine-tuning problem. But that's one of the things that inflation did for us was basically it made the curvature of that bowl be very small, which is to say that anything that is expanding slowly in a small curvature bowl will eventually look like it's not that much of a coincidence. That's a good question. All right, so. So what else do we need? So we know what this expansion rate is. We know A dot over A has this form. And now we just need to figure out what to do with that. So we have this expansion of space, which says you take some bunch of points, and they're all just expanding out. If you take this as the fiducial observer, they're all expanding relative to that. But it would be also the case that if you were to then shift your observer over here, you're going to get the exact same pattern because everything is expanding, which means everything is expanding from everywhere else. So if you want to lay down a grid, some handy coordinates you could use would be the coordinates on some fixed grid something like that, you just put down a grid and you say, well, I know the whole universe is expanding. And since it's all expanding isotropically in the same in every direction, I know that if I have two elements in that universe, well, sure, they're going to stretch away from each other. But that's not such an interesting thing if I want to be able to just orient myself and say which element am I talking about. You can just throw down a coordinate grid. And what you'll find is that you can write all your positions as some a squared of t times some d r squared is c squared dt squared. So this is the metric for an expanding space. And it's just exactly Minkowski space, except that you have this extra expansion that's on top of everything else. So this defines some set of coordinates that you can be using. So you have these things right here. And so this is for photons moving through the universe. So this is your metric. And it's just saying that you have these things expanding. And then you just want to say, and so this coordinate right here is called a co-moving distance. Co-moving coordinates. And it's called co-moving because we've scaled the expansion out of it. So you scale out the expansion, you have these co-moving coordinates. And then what do you want to do with it? Well, so you can then say, well, we actually have this a squared of t right here. We have this dr. So you know that if we just wanted to find some distances between objects, you know that dr is just c dt over a. And so that's saying that if you want to find the distance, so if someone over here emits a photon and that photon starts propagating in, if I want to know how long it takes for something to travel this distance, it's going to be just this integral. So this is the, and so you, if you want to do some integral, you'll then find that any old distance is going to be some integral of c dt over a. And now we could either use a coordinate a, or we could use some new coordinate redshift, where we say that if we look at some object that's over here and the universe is expanded by some amount, there'll be some delta lambda over lambda, and we have some a over a zero is going to be some 1/1 + z, where this is a redshift. And that's just relating the redshifting of photons to the scale of the universe. If I take the universe and I stretch it by some amount, I've stretched all the wavelengths by some amount, and that's just some delta lambda over lambda, just like you got in special relativity with all your Doppler shifts. So you fold that through, and now you get some equation that says r is some dz over this a dot over a times c up there. And why have I written this as a dot over a? Well, because that's the thing we have the equation for. So this a dot over a pops up all over the place. So we've defined this a dot of over a to be the Hubble parameter. And it used to be called the Hubble constant before we realized where it came from. But it's not constant, right? So you look at this, and as long as the energy density of the universe is changing with time, a dot over a is changing with time. So h naught is the value today, and that's the Hubble constant. And that's just the value today. So when you write it this way, you can write this Hubble constant as some h naught squared times some sum over all these densities times rho over some rho crit matter plus anything else you want to use. So I apologize for the people over there that are hidden behind the screen. So I'm just saying that you can take out this 8/3 pi g rho, and you can parameterize it as some critical density. So this is just a definition of this rho crit as 3 h naught squared over 8 pi g. So this is just a parameterization of this, which is just going to your issue of how finely tuned is this. And these things get called the omegas. So this thing right here would be omega matter. This thing here would be omega vacuum. So in general, when you're doing cosmology, what you'll be doing is you'll have this Hubble thing. You have some H squared is H naught squared times omega matter times 1 plus Z cubed plus omega radiation times 1 plus Z to the fourth plus omega dark energy times 1 plus Z to the plus 3 times 1 plus W. And in general, this thing right here is usually very close. It's just a single omega lambda if W equals minus 1, which it's very close to observationally, as we'll see in a second. You go back to this thing, and you can see that we could just plug that in, right? So we have this R is some integral of C dt over A, or it's some dz over H of Z. And so now you can just do these integrals for any universe you want to do. You can do it for anyone you want. Maybe we'll just do it for radiation domination. So in the early universe, this term dominates. If you just take high redshift, this is going as 1 plus z to the fourth, this is 1 plus z cubed, this is almost constant. So early enough, this is always going to dominate. So the very early universe was dominated by radiation, as long as there is some radiation around, which there is. So you just want to plug in this, some integral of dz prime over h of z. And then if it's radiation dominated, you plug this in, and what are you going to get? You'll get that it's equal to CH inverse times 1 minus 1 over 1 plus Z. So this is the thing that pops up everywhere in cosmology, is CH inverse. And this number, it's just a number. So H naught, as you see, is A dot over A. It has units of time. So C times T is a time. And this is to extremely high precision, it's 3,000 megaparsecs. So it's 2997.9 or something. So it's surprisingly, it's more than one sig fig. It's 3,000 megaparsecs. So that's for radiation dominated. If we did the same thing for matter dominated, we get some slightly different number. But you could also just look at the time. You can just integrate up time, because we have A dot over A as a function of A. So you turn that into time, and you get, in general, all your times are going to be just, when you do the calculus, you get some dz over H of Z with an extra factor of 1 plus Z. And this is actually going to be interesting, because it's going to lead to a somewhat surprising result. So you just plug in for radiation dominated again, just for simplicity. You get some H inverse without a C this time. And then you get a over 2 times 1 minus 1 over 1 plus Z squared. And why is this interesting? Well, there's lots of reasons it's interesting, but the one that I find most interesting is that if you actually look, the co-moving distance to something at z of infinity, so as z goes to infinity, which says you're looking at the things that are furthest away that you can see, you get that r goes to ch inverse, and the time looking back, so this is the look-back time, goes to h inverse times a half. You might say, well, those look the same to me, but, in general in astrophysics, up to a factor of a half, that is considered the same. but what's interesting is that C times T is one half R. even though it's traveling at the speed of light. So that says if the universe is 14 billion years old, we could actually see 28 billion light years back. It's funny. You wouldn't expect that because, you know, at least my intuition is that, you know, the speed of light, you can equally well parameterize distances and light travel times. But when you work in this expanding universe, that's not true anymore. And so for a radiation-dominated universe, this factor is a half. For a matter-dominated universe, this factor comes out to be a third. Interesting. So what's going on? Well, what's going on is that light started propagating from way out here and started propagating off in every direction, including towards the ultimate observer. Of course, when it was emitted, it had no idea there was an observer there. So light got emitted and it started propagating. And it's propagating its way through this grid at the speed of light. And this grid is expanding, which means it propagated for some amount of time and it got to, say, this point here. And in the time it then took to get from this point, this whole piece of the universe in behind expanded. And so what it means is that, and so after it passed this and the universe kept on expanding, it gets to bank that time. Because remember, this grid was defined relative, is all defined relative to some fiducial time, like say today. And when this thing started propagating towards us, the universe was much physically smaller by some very large factor of the scale factor. So in physical units, this grid would be scaled down by some very small factor. So this thing started almost here. And then as the light started propagating, space started filling in, but it still got to bank all that stuff that expanded while it was moving along. So you end up with this neat thing that you can actually see further across the universe than you would think just from light travel time. Okay, so the last thing we need to talk about, so how long do I have? I'm basically done, right?
We have time.
Good. Okay. Okay. So now what I've talked about so far is co-moving distance between things. So I'm supposed to be talking about cosmology observations, and I haven't done anything observational yet, right? So as in order to be reimbursed, I have to do something observational.
That's not true.
That's not true? All right then. So what is it that we look at? And now, again, so it's one of these things where we really just have to sort of really go back and think very carefully about what distances mean. So when I look somewhere, how can I tell how far something is from me? So there's a few different ways of doing it. So one way is to be bouncing light back and forth. But that doesn't work very well as astronomers because we can send all the signals we want and we generally don't get very much back. So we can do it to the moon because we sent people there to put little corner reflectors, so they say. So we can then do lunar laser ranging to the moon. So you basically shoot laser beams at the moon and they bounce back. And then we can do things like measure the distance to the moon, and that's how we know that it's moving away from us at 3 centimeters per year. However, we can't do that in most other places. It's very difficult. So yeah, we can do radar ranging of the planets, but we're not going to do very well in cosmology that way. So light travel times are a tough way to go. So how else can we do it? Well, you can do things like you can peek around. You can say, well, I think I see that clock over there. And I'm assuming that that clock is not absurdly small or large. And then I can use my everyday intuition for how big clocks are to figure out how far that wall is away from me. So that's one way to do it, is that you can just use the fact that you have something of length L that subtends some angle, and you can use that to estimate some distance. And this is what's known as the angular size distance. And so now we've reduced the problem to just basically finding a whole bunch of standard rulers scattered around the universe. So if you know exactly how long something is, anywhere it is in the universe, if you can measure how big it appears to be, you have a measurement of how far away it is. Now, so one thing about this is that in general, if you imagine a ruler or, well, okay, a hockey stick is a bad example because they come in all different sizes. But imagine you knew exactly how long this hockey stick was. If you were to find hockey sticks halfway across the universe, and you knew, you looked at it and you said, oh, that's the CCM vector. So therefore, I know exactly how big that is. And so you look it up in your catalog, and you know exactly how big it is. Now, that's the CCM vector, but this isn't a co-moving CCM vector, which is to say that if there was some CCM vector in the early universe, it's probably this long in real physical units, because they got to play hockey with it. Right? It doesn't help them to be using some little tiny little stick because the universe has been expanding. So in general, when you're using these standard rulers of any kind, what you're working with is some physical length L. And that's not co-moving, which means if you stick it down at different points in time, that corresponds to a different co-moving coordinate. But as you're propagating through this universe, when you're going through this grid, as long as the universe is spatially flat, photon geodesics do straight lines through this co-moving grid, which means that what will happen is that you, when you observe this thing, since the universe has expanded, this ruler will appear to be shorter for a fixed angle, which is to say that what you actually see is that the angle that you see is some co-moving length over this angular size distance. And so what is this co-moving length? Well, this co-moving length is, well, so compared to that grid, if it's this big today, that means that compared to that grid, if it's still that big and the grid is shrunk, that means it looks enormous on the grid. So this co-moving length, I just want to make sure I don't confuse myself here before I confuse you guys. Good. So what that means is that you get the dA is actually, oh wait, what do I want to do? Is actually this co-moving distance, r, over 1 plus z. And the reason for that, and so it's smaller, and the reason it's smaller is, so let me just sort of figure out what this is. So it's a co-moving length, which is the physical size that it is, and in co-moving coordinates, something that's the same size has this factor of 1 plus z. So if you wanted to just, and so this theta right here, oh, it's co-moving length, sorry. It's a co-moving length over just the actual distance because we're in co-moving coordinates. So we have this co-moving length and we have this distance. I knew I was going to confuse myself. So that's L over 1 plus Z over this distance. So this angular diameter distance is actually the co-moving distance over 1 plus z. And that's just because it looks like it's huge. Because so that clock's over there. The two photons started coming towards me, and they were some distance apart. While they were propagating, the transverse distance stretched because the whole universe expanded. So when I see them come in, I see them coming in this way, which means I think that clock is much closer. So the angular diameter distance is off by this factor of 1 plus z. We can equally well talk about a co-moving distance. A different distance would be winding down. The standard McGill lectures are only 50 minutes.
There's no backpack.
No, that's good. But I want to make sure I show some data. So we just got to get this last thing. All right. So the angular diameter distance gets us factor of 1 over 1 plus z. So what's another way we can measure distance? Well, I can look. So let's say you're out playing on the train tracks, and you see a train coming towards you, and you want to know how far away it is. So if you were playing on the highway, you could use the change in the separation of the headlights, and then you're using the angular diameter distance. But if you're out in the train yard, all you have to work with is the brightness of that train light. And that says you have some source, and it's emitting in all directions, always outwards. And you know that the measured flux is the luminosity, which is the intrinsic brightness of that, over 4 pi r squared. And that's just saying the further away you go, it drops as 1 over r squared. So classic 1 over r squared, and what could possibly get messed up by that? So just to be suggestive, I'm going to say that that's some luminosity over 4 pi. I'm going to write this as d sub l squared. Almost got it. That must actually be chalk up here, right? Can people see the orange? All right, so 4 pi dl squared. And now you have to figure out exactly what it is that you're going to measure in an expanding universe. So now let's say we have our co-moving grid. So we have our co-moving grid, and it has to be the case that all the photons that come out of here are going to propagate through this co-moving grid. So it seems like we've got it trapped, right? What could possibly go wrong? Well, the problem is this luminosity. Is energy emitted per second? Energy emitted per second. And that still seems pretty clear until I say energy emitted per second, and I say that it's at the time of emission. And okay, you're saying, okay, well, he must have said that for a reason. Flux is energy received per second per, say, square centimeters, because I'm an astronomer. And this is at time of receiving. And here's the problem. The problem is that the universe is expanding, and so all wavelengths are stretching, which means all clocks are getting delayed by a factor of 1 plus z. If you look at something that's halfway, that's at a cosmological redshift of 1, that clock is running at half the speed as we see it. And so you get a factor of 1 plus z from the per second, and you also get a factor of 1 plus z from the energy of the photons. So those photons have been shifted to longer wavelengths. So what it means is that the flux you receive is going to be the luminosity over 4 pi r squared. And then there's going to be an extra factor of 1 over 1 plus z squared. And so these two factors right here are from time dilation and energy redshifting. So that's from time and energy. Whereas in the case of the angular diameter distance, it was just coming from geodesics getting stretched apart. So what this means is that if you define this as dl, this tells you that dl is r times 1 plus z. So they differ. This one gets smaller. This one gets bigger. Now, I'll show you in a second that this is actually trickier than you think. Because, so the per second is pretty, that's pretty much a lock. That's just saying your stretch, cosmological clocks are running at a different speed as you see them. So therefore, this one, this factor 1 plus z is pretty much unavoidable. Energy received is a little funny. Because you know what, not all, when you make a real observation, you're never measuring all of the energy that's been emitted. You're only measuring in some accessible band. And so you have to be able to figure out what accessible band you're measuring in your rest wavelength compared to the emitted wavelength. And I'll show you an example of that in a second. Okay. So I think, so this is the expanding universe. And so, the important things to remember are just the distances always have some funniness to them. That the luminosity distance, you have a 1 plus z up there, angular distances is on the bottom. But for the most part, there's nothing really crazy going on. So let's just now go back to basics and say, what do I mean by all these things? So I think, at least for me, I find when you see a picture of these things, you can really see what's going on. So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has quasars that go out to redshifts of almost 7. And what you have is you have here an example of a cosmological redshift. And so this is wavelength going this way. And this, the intensity scale right here, and quasars have bright emission lines. And what do you see? Well, you don't even have to be able to see any of the scale. As long as you know wavelength's increasing this way, what you see is, oh, wow, there are these bright pairs of lines all over the place. But they seem to just be shifting to the right. And so this is exactly what they mean by a redshift. It's the definition of a redshift. So we say that this thing is at a redshift of 0.3 because it's been redshifted. This line right here is over here. This one's been moved to here. And you can just see that it's just a carbon copy that's just been shifted on the wavelength axis. And this was discovered in 1912 in galaxies. So long before we realized the universe was expanding, we saw all sorts of things that were redshifted. And almost everything was redshifted, but people didn't really attribute anything to it. They weren't quite sure what to make of it. So
why
here
we can see the same object in different redshifts. I would have thought they'd be fixed essentially.
So these are all different objects.
Oh, okay.
So this is, if I had zoomed in on, if I had proper resolution, you'd see they all have different long telephone numbers. Quasars, so these are all different objects, but quasars are basically, there's a wide class of them that are all almost identical. They're all basically these bright blue dots at the centers of galaxies that are much brighter than all other galaxies, and they all look roughly like this. So these are all different objects, what you see is that if you're to extend this out to redshift 6, what you can see, and if you actually go to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey website, they've got an example of this where you actually see the thing that's been classed as a quasar is getting physically redder. That you actually see that little insight, and it's getting redder and redder and redder. So in cosmology, we're always sort of stuck with this averaging thing. You just have to assume that you're seeing some population at different redshifts. And then you have to hope that it's the same population at different redshifts and that they haven't evolved. Now, for something like quasars, it's really hard to come up with something that's going to just make things at different distances have different velocities that's non-cosmological. So here's the data that basically Slipher was working with something more like this. And so here is just you put a slit down on a galaxy, and then it disperses the light. So it's just a diffraction grating, basically. And so you put a slit down, and if he looks at something in, say, Virgo, you see some bright lines that are right here. You see this gap in the spectrum right there. And then you look at something, so Ursa Major is a different galaxy cluster. And you see it's moved, and then Corona Borealis is some yet different one. These are all relatively nearby, but you just see that these dots are moving. And so you see here that astronomers, so here it seems pretty clear cut, and then out here, clearly astronomers are some magic creature where they can see gaps there and not there. But they're magic, and they seem to always be right. So this was in the 1910s. And what was found is that basically everything was moving away from us. And that was 1910. So this is my favorite Einstein quote. To desider on the idea of an expanding universe. To admit such possibilities seems senseless. That's great. So there's Edwin Hubble. So Edwin Hubble is one of the guys in here. I think he's this one, but I'm not sure which one he is. A man of magnificent physique, admirable scholarship, and a worthy and lovable character. So what more could you want? So they actually won the... The University of Chicago won the Big Ten title in 1909. So I don't know if any of you know anything about basketball. But the Big Ten is like serious basketball. And the University of Chicago, I don't even know if they still have a basketball team. So it was a different time. So what was he doing? So what Edwin Hubble looked at were Cepheid variables. And so a Cepheid variable has the property that it looks like this. So the apparent magnitude, so this is just how bright it is, except it's plotted upside down because to an astronomer, a small magnitude is brighter than a faint magnitude. And that's just because some loyalty to astronomers from 2,000 years ago that basically ranks stars in the sky based on their apparent brightness, where zero, where the brightest were the zeroth magnitude ones and the faintest were the fifth. And we decided we like that scale, so we're still using it. But if you plot how bright it is, so this is brightness versus period. And what you find is that Cepheid variables have this property that they go up and down in time. And so the prototype of Cepheid variables is Delta Cephei. So Cepheus is looks like a house in the sky. So the fourth brightest star in Cepheus is the prototype for this. And so for this particular one, you see there's some period that's 5.4 days. And people make catalogs of these things of nearby stars. Oh, this is Delta C. And what they find empirically is that the absolute magnitude, which is, again, how bright it is versus its period in days, has a fairly tight relation. So the longer the period, the brighter these things are. So if you see a 30-day period Cepheid variable, you know that it should be extremely bright. And if you see one that's very quick, it shouldn't be nearly as bright. And the physics of this is quite complicated. It has to do with you have a star, and the surface near the surface of the star, the atmosphere is expanding or contracting a little bit. And as it expands or contracts a little bit, you get changes in the ionization state. So you'll do things like helium will get a little bit more ionized or a little less ionized. And radiation coming through, depending on exactly how ionized helium is, will have a tendency to get either more or less trapped. So you get this interaction between this breathing mode up and down and how efficiently it can allow radiation to pass or trap it. And so you'll get things like it'll do some contraction and then it'll trap radiation more effectively, which means it'll heat up and it'll go, and then suddenly the fuse will let out and the thing will expand again. So you get these expanding and contracting going on. And there's sort of a region in stars, and it corresponds to some magic surface temperature that's usually somewhere around the ionization state of helium, where a lot of stars show this pulsation. So there's R Lyra variables, there's Cepheids. It's called the instability streak. And it's just this interaction between ionization, temperature, radiation getting through. So these were known for, since I think maybe even before 1800 was the first time these things were discovered. But around 1910, Henrietta Leavitt was the one that discovered this relation right here. And so she found that there was this relation between how bright the thing was and its period. So what Hubble said is he said, oh, well, that's great. Now all I need to do is go find a bunch of Cepheids in other galaxies, and then I'll know exactly how bright they are. And now I can do this luminosity distance, although he didn't think about it that way. He didn't realize the universe was expanding. He was thinking of it this way, which is, how could this possibly be wrong? Flux is luminosity over 4 pi r squared. I measure the period, that tells me how intrinsically bright it is. I measure the flux, that tells me how bright it appears. Now I have a distance. That's what Hubble did. And here's what he found. He found that if he plotted the apparent redshift, so this is the velocity of the object versus distance, you get a curve that looks like this. So this was the data that said that the universe was expanding. So historically, he got the wrong answer because it turns out there's two types of Cepheids. There's really bright ones and much fainter ones. And so he was off by almost a factor of 10 in the whole distance scale. However, since it was a global scaling and he was looking at the same populations in all the galaxies, the overall offset was wrong in terms of these distances, but the slope was still fine. But on a log-log scale, everything was fine. So this was fine. It said the universe was expanding, and then everyone said, oh yeah, clearly it's expanding. And then after that, lots of things happened. So this is what we all agree now, is that the universe is expanding. So here's what it looks like today. Here, and then further back in the past, the whole universe would be shrunk down. As we look out, we're looking further and further back in time. which means we're looking further back in time to times when the universe was smaller. So from here to here, the universe is stretched, which means we will see light coming from here as being redshifted by some factor. This is how the scale factor works, is that we're looking back in time to when the universe was in a more compact state, so everything we see today has been stretched by some amount. Okay, so this seems, you know, this over, what was this? That was 1929, so over 60 years, 65 years, people were just trying to figure out exactly what rate this expansion was going by looking at things relatively nearby using the same things that Hubble was doing. And so at the time, what people were trying to do was exactly this idea of saying, what's the size of the universe versus time? So that's another way of plotting the same thing. So instead of the size, if we put in, so this is A versus T. So if you plot this luminosity distance, you calculate this luminosity distance, it's the co-moving distance versus 1 plus Z, and then you go back to your co-moving distance equations. And so if you measure this versus redshift, you can use that to infer the expansion history. And so what people were trying to do was actually figure out exactly what the expansion history was. So a flat universe would just barely coast to a stop at infinity, a closed universe would recollapse, open universe keep going forever. And that, so the one that blew this open was the type 1a supernovae. So here are type 1a supernovae. And so here are a bunch of galaxies. You know, they have names, but it doesn't even really matter. Here's before, actually this is after, but it works as before or after. So this is not while the supernova is going off. This is while the supernova is going off. You have not a supernova, supernova, no supernova, supernova. This one's a very clear one, supernova, no supernova. These are the same galaxies and the supernova's gone. And so what are these things? Well, so in some sense, it doesn't matter what they are, in some sense, in that all, you know, we can entirely empirically characterize that when we see objects that look like this at low redshift, we know, we find the distance to the host galaxy through Cepheids or whatever we want to use. And what we typically find is that all of these dots tend to all have the intrinsic same brightness. So that's an empirical fact. And now, that's a little unsatisfying. It'd be nice to actually have some principle by which you know that these things should all be the same. And over many years of trying to understand exactly what these things are, so it long predates using them as cosmological probes, the consensus came to be that these things are exploding white dwarfs. And so why do white dwarfs explode? You might think it's a funny thing for them to do. There's no reason they should. So the reason they explode has to do with a very funny thing, a quirk of astrophysics, that if you plot the theoretical white dwarf radius versus its mass, it has some property that looks like this. Its radius, as it gets bigger, the radius goes to zero. And that's weird. Most things get more massive. As they get more massive, you expect them to be physically larger. Certainly, that's my experience playing hockey. So what's going on here? Well, what's going on here is it's basically just solid state physics. So what is it? What is a white dwarf? Why is a white dwarf a white dwarf? Well, it's a white dwarf because it can't do any nuclear burning anymore. And why can't it do any nuclear burning anymore? Well, so what's happened is that it's basically been locked into some configuration where you have, so it used to be the center of some star and it went through some burning stages where you had some hydrogen burning into helium and a core, and then maybe you had a shell on top. Who knows what was going on, but you have this structure where this thing is undergoing nuclear burning. And at any one point, eventually this core will run out of energy. When this core runs out of energy, It's no longer, or when it runs out of hydrogen, it can't burn to helium anymore. The star loses its central energy source. And then it just, and so at this point, there's lots of energy coming out of the core because it's undergoing nuclear fusion. And the temperature down here will be something like 10 to the 7 Kelvin, or maybe some 10 to the 8, something like that. And it's happily undergoing nuclear fusion, but then it stalls. And it stalls because it effectively has run out of hydrogen. And at that point, you're left with a lump of helium at the center, and then some shell on top where it's now turning hydrogen into helium on the shell. But this helium is just a dead lump. And it's just going to sit there as a dead lump until this core contracts to the point where it can light helium and start burning helium through to carbon. And that happens at a higher temperature because helium has more charge. So the result of that is that eventually, as this star sits there, eventually it'll get compressed enough that it can light helium. And that'll generally happen. You have some gas, and if you just keep pushing on it and pushing on it and pushing on it, eventually it's going to get to the point where the temperature will go high enough that you can light it. Now, what happens in some situations is if before you can light these cores, sometimes what will happen is it'll get dense enough that degeneracy pressure kicks in, which is to say it becomes more like this, that it becomes held up by quantum mechanics instead of by thermal pressure. And once it gets held up by quantum mechanics instead of thermal pressure, then pushing on it more doesn't raise the temperature. So eventually, in some objects, and it really just depends on exactly what the mass, where it is in mass and radius, eventually you'll get some objects where the core is supported by quantum degeneracy pressure. So it basically becomes almost like a metal. And so basically the Fermi energy of this thing is higher than anything that you can supply via just thermal pressure, and you pile more mass on, and it's just rigid. It's just this thing right here. And that core is just stuck like that. And at that point, it's just going to sit there. And now, so this is what a white dwarf is. A white dwarf has this degenerate core, and it'll have a little bit of stuff on top, but not very much. Because eventually this core on top will get blown off. And eventually you have a nearly naked quantum degeneracy pressure supported object. And it'll be relatively cold compared to all these other things, and we'll just be sitting. And so that's a white dwarf. And now you have to say, okay, I now have this solid state material that's sitting there. And what does it mean to be degeneracy pressure? Well, we have the Pauli exclusion principle, which says we can't add another electron into the same state as one that's already occupied. So I want to take an electron, and I want to add it to this thing. And it just won't fit. But the only way, all the low-level energy levels are filled, which means I can only insert this thing if it comes in at sufficiently high energy. So it says that if I want to grow this white dwarf, I have to add stuff only at high energy. But all of my energy is coming from gravity. So if I want to add new stuff at high energy, the only way I can do that is if I'm making the whole object more tightly bound. That's the only way I can add new material, is by having this core be more compact. And so in order for a white dwarf to get to be this big, it has to be compact enough that I can put an electron in at high enough energy that it can fill all the levels below. And if all you do is you just do some accounting where you say you have some gravitational energy, which is of order G m squared over r, and I have some Fermi energy, which is of order the number of electrons that I'm packing in there times some Fermi energy, and I calculate this Fermi energy by just saying that I'm just going to fill states in every direction, in all three directions. This turns out to be n times n to the 1/3 hc over r, order of magnitude. And then you just set these two things equal to each other, and lo and behold, what's going to pop out is that something bad happens at 1.4 solar masses. So this isn't how Chandrasekhar did it, but this is a simple way to derive the Chandrasekhar limit. This is how Landau did it. So what's happening here is that as I'm piling stuff on, this white dwarf is just contracting and contracting and contracting, and it's also getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And eventually what's going to happen is it's going to get hot enough to light this core and start burning it through to carbon. And as soon as that happens, I've now lit the core, but there's no thermal pressure that's there to compensate. So it suddenly releases a huge amount of energy, but the star is not going to expand because the thermal pressure is minimal compared to all this other stuff that's going on. So it just gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and it burns faster and faster and faster. And what you get is you get to the whole star just explosively just goes off. So this is a time scale of a few seconds. This is less than a second. In less than a second, this whole object is. So here's a simulation of something.
What's the distance to?
What was that?
The size.
What's the size of a white dwarf?
1,000 kilometers.
1,000 kilometers?
No, kilometer. I think that's scale in 1,000 kilometers, right? The scale of the white dwarf.
I think that seems about right. The radius of the sun is like 10 to the 10 centimeters, the white dwarf is 10 to the 5, so it should be 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 centimeters.
Yep. If this thing is rigid, won't we expect m to go as r cubed?
M?
Just normal matter. If this thing is rigid.
Well, there's still some equation of state. Like, it's not completely rigid. It's, you know, just like, so you have your orbitals, and you can compress them. There's no magic density to atomic matter, right? So if I can make atoms denser, denser by squeezing them, and that's fine. When it breaks down is when I get to the nuclear density. Because when I squeeze a nucleus, it's hard to make that denser, and that's where neutron stars come from. But as long as we're out here, we're just at the scale of imagining everything's packed in, and all the atoms are right, have overlapping orbitals, and then squeezing. And we're still allowed to do that up to a point. So this is what we think is going on. Now, there's all sorts of questions, like we're adding new stuff on, where does it come from? So 5 years ago, someone would have said, oh, well, it's some binary companion, and it's a white dwarf with some star orbiting, and that star is just dumping matter onto the surface. This thing grows and grows and grows. Eventually, it lights. And what's becoming clear is that doesn't work, that there aren't enough of those systems around, there's planes, and now people are thinking maybe it's two white dwarfs running into each other. So it's an active argument about exactly how these things end up creating all this extra mass, but the bottom line is that everyone seems to agree that it has to do with things getting very close to the Chandrasekhar limit and getting hot enough to just completely blow off and unbottom. So this is one reason why you might think that they would all look roughly the same, because they all get close to this limit, and then they blow, which means they're all at roughly some reasonably uniform property. So it's not crazy that they would all look the same. On the other hand, if someone said they're all different, no one would really bat an eye. And so if you just plot the light curve of these things so this is brightness versus time, what you find is that it goes up. So these are a bunch of nearby type 1a supernovae going up, going off, and then fading away over a time scale of maybe 30 days. They go up. And now what someone noticed, so Mr. Phillips noticed, that these dim ones fall fastest. And the bright ones fall slowest. And if all you do is you do some correction, like you say, well, what if I try to shift them to some common scale where I correct the slow ones so that they look more like these ones in the middle, and I correct the fast ones so that they look more like the ones in the middle, just by empirically saying there's some relation between how quickly they fall off versus how their peak brightness. What he found is that he could correct for that extremely well. But just by saying, how long does it take for that light curve to go up and down, can I guess how bright it's going to be? And you just plot some corrected brightness versus time, and you see that this is a very tight curve. And that says you see a supernova go off, and you know exactly how bright it is. And that should be true anywhere in the universe, as long as these things aren't doing anything funny. And so with that, you can now make a Hubble law that looks like this. So here's velocity versus distance using these supernovae instead of using cepheids from Hubble. So this is 70 years of progress. And instead of going out to where Hubble was going, which was down here, it's now going out to So, and then when you look really carefully at that curve, what you find is that if you then try to plot some brightness versus redshift, so this is basically taking that same curve and kind of tipping it over a little bit, and then extending it out to slightly higher redshift, what you find is that it's in this regime down here, and then what they found is that things weren't slowing down as effectively as they thought. That there's some 1 over r squared law, and then on top of that 1 over r squared, things are actually getting a little bit more distant than you would expect them to be. And this is the evidence for dark energy. And it's just saying that if omega lambda is equal to 0 and omega matter is equal to 1, you should live on this curve right here. And what that's saying is that things that are further away, which is to say things that are fainter, should in general, or this distance away from us, they should have a redshift that's here, and instead they have a redshift that's here. And so you do that geometry, and what you find, if you find the expansion history of the universe looks like this. And if you plot the size of the universe versus time, the supernova data is right here. So here's today. Here's the nearby stuff. You look at some object that's at a cosmological redshift that corresponds to this scale factor. And you measure some distance for it. You can convert that into an age. And they do this, and what you find is that things look like relatively linear expansion per year, and that's just because the first order, everything's linear. And then as you get further and further away, what you find is that the stuff that's further back in the past seems to be expanding at a different rate than you would expect if the universe had just gone through some steady slowing down. So what you'd expect is that the universe was just always slowing down. As you went back in the past, it should just be expanding faster and faster. And instead, what you're finding is that in the past, the universe was expanding at a different rate than you would expect. So this means the expansion is actually speeding up. So here's the expansion rate versus time. And so what you expect is that the expansion rate, as time goes forward, this is look-back time, so this is the beginning of the universe is right here, what you would have expected is that the universe should be slowing down. And in fact, it was for most of the universe's history. And the reason for that is just right there, which is to say, as long as the universe is dominated by normal matter, it's going to be decelerating. And at high redshift, this density is constant. These two densities are increasing, which means that in the past, the universe was strongly dominated by stuff that's not constant in time and space. Which is to say, in general, it was decelerating exactly as you would expect. Now, mysteriously, somewhere around 6 billion years ago, 5 billion years ago, the expansion basically turned around and has now started accelerating. And this is the evidence for the universe being full of dark energy. And it says, and if you calculate exactly what it means, what we arrive at is the idea that the universe is today about 30% matter, and about 70% of whatever this stuff is. And so I think the supernovae are sort of the cleanest version of this, where it's easiest to see where this is coming from. But there are lots of other ways. So sort of every cosmological probe is now in agreement that the expansion history has done something like this. It's slowed down, slowed down, slowed down, as expected. Boom, dark energy kicks in. And now we're entering this phase of the universe starting to accelerate away. Now, to give you a sense of why this might be even harder than you might think it is, here's a visualization of that K correction I talked about, which is to say, when we're measuring a luminosity distance, we're in general not measuring all the energy. So here's the flux from the supernova as a function of wavelength. Here it is at some redshift. There's the spectrum. And in general, you do some measurement with a telescope. You don't measure all the photons. Instead, you just take some filter and you measure all the flux in some window. And so what you can try to do is you can try to get your filter to be well matched to something. But you take supernovae at two different redshifts, say 0.47 and 0.65. And if for the same spectrum, so this is the background spectrum,
And if you redshift into the rest frame of that same object, what happens is that you're moving around where your filters are falling relative to the peaks. So for this object right here, the peak of this filter corresponds closely with the rest frame emission of the supernova at that spot right there. That's this thing right here. It corresponds very closely to that. But because this thing's been redshifted by a ratio of 1.47 by 1.65, the actual filter in the rest frame of this object is falling at a shorter wavelength. And it means that this filter right here is actually probing this more of this feature here than that. So it's basically, when you're comparing these two supernovae with each other, this experiment right here is measuring something that's close to this line. And this one up here is measuring one that's close to there. So if you now want to compare these two supernovae with each other, you need to know something about exactly what the relative flux is at this wavelength compared to this wavelength. And you also need to know stuff about exactly how well calibrated your various experiments are. So it's a tricky enterprise, and this is why Shrami is not always as easy as you might think. All right, so there's the summary. So the universe is expanding, and I hope I convinced you that expansion or contraction is actually the norm. But if the universe was not expanding or contracting, that would be unbelievably strange. And just from Newtonian physics, it has to be true. And yeah, you need GR to figure out how to include radiation and dark energy and things like that. But in general, this is exactly what you would expect. So mucking around with time and distance measures is something that the expansion does, that it gives you these extra factors of a half and two-thirds or three all over the place, depending on exactly what the universe is. It used to be hot and dense, now it's not. This universe used to be hot, and then it got old. And it's currently dominated by something which seems roughly constant, and that's the dark energy. So, all right, so hopefully you're now a little bit more comfortable with the expanded universe. It shouldn't be creepy to anyone. It's not weird. It's just, everything's just normal physics, and it happens to be some fluid that's expanded. And so now that we know that, we can go on and figure out everything we need to know about the CMB tomorrow.
Okay, so we're